today. We've got with us a real honor to have David Butler, the executive director of the Knoxville Museum of Art. So how are the folks out there, Dave?
Glad to be here.
There we go.
You're actually at my place, so it's easy. That's easy for me.
We are. We're actually
thanks for coming over.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually on site here at the KMA. And for those of you who end up watching on this end of it, of which I'm pointing at the camera, we're actually going to film a little bit of this and put it on our social media
channels.
I'm not
looking.
No, don't. Don't look away.
You're not going to see.
But anyway, today we're going to talk to David about what brought sort of the road that leads a man to Knoxville, Tennessee, and what it's like behind the scenes in the art world. What are people going through and what are people doing? So let's get things kicked off. David, where are you from?
Grew up in Florida.
Yeah.
Originally went to Florida State. This was a very long time ago. And and since then I have lived many, many places in my field. You travel around, you got to move around to move up.
Well, talk about your field for a second. A lot of the folks that we have talked to have come to the arts or their involvement in the arts somewhat circuitously, like started somewhere and ended somewhere else. Like, what did you go to school for?
Art history.
Okay.
I remember in junior college in Cocoa, Florida, had a terrible teacher. I don't think she'd ever taught art history before. I was a studio major, and you take drawing and painting and all that. And took my first art history class. She couldn't have been a worse teacher. It didn't matter because I was in love from it. As soon as the lights went down and the first image came, boy, I'm in. Had no idea, like, did people make a living doing this? Not really, not just looking at slides, but I was ready. I was committed at that moment. And I found out, there's this such thing as art history, and you study and travel and kind of learn how all those things fit together and how they connect to how they connect to us directly and indirectly. And it's pretty fascinating. And I've been lucky that I've been able to make a living at that all these years. I tell people I did my graduate work at Washington University in St. Louis in 17th century Italian art and architecture. So I always tell people, because it's true, that I'm trained to read and interpret palace documents from the 17th century in the state archives in Rome. And I work in community development in Southern Appalachia, and it's a perfect fit. It works out great.
A straight line.
Yeah, it's completely not a straight line, but it's like most people's lives. You don't get to plan it out. Things happen. You respond to circumstances. You're lucky or you're unlucky. You follow one road, not another, and it's everybody's story is interesting. And
absolutely.
And nobody could have predicted how it was going to turn out. And you hope you didn't screw it up. You hope you didn't make too many bad decisions along the way. I think coming to Knoxville was a really good decision. It's been a really good situation for me, and I hope for the institution. And it's a place I've come to love very much. And
yeah, it's I've lived in East Tennessee. I mean, my whole life. Traveled around, a bit, but I mean, obviously, I'm inclined towards the region as well.
Something very special about it.
Well, tell me a little bit about, like, you're talking about that sort of first slide that came down, right, when you were a kid. For those of you who are listening, there used to be things called slides.
They were actual pieces of glass with masking tape, held together with masking tape.
Because I remember that experience. As a freshman or sophomore in college, as an art major, and having work that I had not seen before, and not even understanding that kind of thing I didn't know that was a thing.
It wasn't part of my growing up either.
Yeah.
I think it opened up a whole world to me that I didn't even know existed. I kind of grew up in the orange groves and had a wonderful childhood and upbringing, but it wasn't very culturally diverse or sophisticated. It was kind of a small town near the ocean, and I think those slides were just such they were a window to this rich, wonderful, huge world out there that I would just, and I think at that moment I realized, oh gosh, this is something that I can be involved with too. And
yeah,
I hope one of my ambitions for the KMA is that that for some people, we're that place where that process still happens for, you know, for a kid who maybe doesn't have a lot of affirmation, and they don't think there's any way for them to change their situation and get out into the world. And I hope we can be kind of a window to all kind of possibilities for people. It's not for everybody, but I think, you know, one kid in 10 was like, I wasn't able to articulate this, but that's where I want to go. If you look at the Buford Delaney show upstairs and gosh, come see that. It's an absolute miracle and revelation. A poor kid from East Knoxville who was feted around the world, and it's a great Knoxville story. It's a great international kind of arty story, and somebody that was beloved and connected to really plugged into to some of the most amazing people in the 20th century, real cultural luminaries who adored this man, who never made much money, and he had mental issues and struggled with all kind of problems, but people came to sit at his feet and just kind of soak in his persona, and you really feel that in the show when you see all that work together that the museum's been able to acquire just in the last very few years. This is very non-linear, isn't it?
Oh, it's working. That's why we like, people tune in and they want the real.
That show is one of those portals. And
I'll cover this again in a little bit, but also like how long is that up?
It's up till the middle of July.
Okay. So So people will have several more weeks once this goes live.
About five more weeks. Yeah.
Cool. To go and check it out. And at the KMA, the Knoxville Museum of Art, knoxart.org. We will go back and forth a little bit, but I think one of the cool things that I know that you have been a part of, or that the organization has kind of pushed over the last decade, is a combination of searching out artists that were and are overlooked from a regional perspective, or even from a local, in the case of Buford Delaney.
People connected to this place in the world.
Yeah. And then also, you can come and it's free.
Always free. Yeah, that's the first thing I did when I got here is I talked my board into dropping the admission price, and there was a lot of fear. Oh gosh, people won't value what they don't pay for. But if you'd ever stood at the front lobby and watched someone walk away because they didn't want to pay $5, and it's a really dispiriting kind of experience. I thought that should never happen.
Sure,
you should. I like to say we don't charge you when you come in. We just say, welcome. We're glad you're here. Here's what's going on. We get to know you and then ask for money later. And that really works out better. And people are happy. People are happy to support what we're doing.
Sure.
We were worried, oh gosh, who will want to be a member if you get in free anyway? Well, our members like the fact that their membership makes it possible for us to be free. Nobody gets turned away at the front door because they can't or won't.
Right.
Or won't pay.
Well, thus sort of fulfilling that mission of being potentially that first slide.
Yeah.
For who knows what kind of kid or what kind of grown up or what kind of anybody comes in and has an experience that they would otherwise not, you know, have access to.
There are so many barriers, and if going to museums is something that you take for granted, just part of your normal experience, you don't see all those barriers, but boy, they are there. And the least we can do is take away the obvious visible one, which is charging admission.
Sure.
If you're going to the Metropolitan, you expect to pay. That's a tourist attraction. But we want to be a place where people who live in Knoxville can kind of discover themselves, but discover their hometown, and where people who are from other places can. We actually get the best feedback from people from other cities, and they're delighted to see, oh gosh, there's a real culture here. There's a real history over several centuries. There's been a lot's been going on here.
Sure.
And I don't think any of us knew we always knew Knoxville was a music place. I think we're very in touch with our musical selves historically and even now. I think people that aren't from Knoxville, sorry, people that are from Knoxville, never lived anywhere else, think it's normal that there are pages and pages and pages of live performance in the paper every weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, there's a whole other.
That's not normal.
Yeah. As folks that travel even to other similar sized cities attest to that sort of culture, that piece of the cultural artifact is in Knoxville very strong.
Yeah, but the visual culture is really strong too. And I don't think we ever, as a community, we really embrace that part of ourselves. And that's really my biggest ambition for the KMA is that we're that place that really pushes that and publicizes it and celebrates what's happened here in terms of the visual arts. And it's such a long, rich, complicated, diverse story. And there's just so many big players that connect to the rest of the world too. And it's a two-way conversation too. Things come from here, go out, and things from the outside world come in. And, to me, it's kind of a model of how we've always functioned as a community, where we kind of, there's this kind of yin and yang. Mm-hmm. We're outward looking, progressive, building railroads, connecting to the world. Then we kind of shrink back in ourselves and are distrustful of outsiders. And you can kind of, if you look at the kind of the cycle of history in Knoxville and East Tennessee, you have that kind of back and forth. And I think we're in a real expansive period now, and we're really connected to the bigger world, and we're really open to the world. I hope it stays that way. We've had if you see our permanent installation upstairs, it's called Higher Ground. It opens with a section called something like Big Ambitions or Great Ambitions. It was, you know, 100-120 years ago when we were going to be the next Atlanta or Nashville, and that was reflected in kind of the ambition and quality of artists who were making their living here. Really, there was a really vital artistic community. Then it all kind of went away. And
this is a great thing for folks. So there is a very rich visual history from Knoxville. What would be historically? I want to get into some of our more modern artists, you know, obviously here shortly, but historically, who would you recommend somebody look up or look to kind of learn more about that?
Well, and the obvious one is Lloyd Branson, who there are a lot of pieces of his biography we're not sure about, but he's the first full-time professional artist in Knoxville, started working in the late 19th century and died at a very advanced age in the 1920s. And he fostered, mentored, and supported a whole generation of artists who came after him. He was like the role model. He sort of showed them how it was done. His great protege was Catherine Wiley, who I always say if Catherine Wiley was not female and wasn't from East Tennessee, she'd be really famous. She's a genius impressionist, and you see her things upstairs and at the East Tennessee History Center and few other places around town, and they absolutely will make you weep. They're mm-hmm. so beautiful, and I would put them up against anything happening in the United States and even Europe. We were a little behind the curve in terms of what was happening in Europe, but in American terms, she's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And people don't know about her. We've been able to accumulate a number of her important works, and actually have some more coming in on loan from some of her descendants, which are really excited about.
Oh, awesome.
And then Buford Delaney, who was also a protege of Lloyd Branson. That's a really great story too, where Buford and his brother Joseph Delaney, who's also an artist, who came of age in the teens and in the early 20s, and where it simply wasn't possible to operate as an African American mm-hmm. in the Jim Crow South, and he got them to got Buford up to Boston. I think he got Joe to Chicago or New York. I can't remember. But he made it possible for them to pursue their education and pursue careers as independent, successful artists. And There's a wonderful kind of line of succession for a long time, and but the personal connections between these kind of seminal figures in the local visual art scene. But it's worth noting that next generation, Lloyd Branson made it here as an artist. He was really skilled entrepreneur. He knew how to kind of make a living and churn out portraits and do kind of his own more artistic work when he could. The generation after that really couldn't make it here.
Even the Delaney, you said, was had issues. So there's that sort of period, the mid-century, where a lot of that visual stuff kind of drops off, or
after the 20s. Yeah. Okay. There just wasn't, you know, it was the Depression. There were all kind of reasons why it was a different situation. Things kind of pick up again, after World War II, when, UT, sets up its art department.
Gotcha.
A lot of talents coming to town for working for TVA, for UT, and Knoxville really has its own incredibly vigorous and interesting local school called the Knoxville Seven, who they organized themselves very self-consciously. Buck Ewing was the ringleader of that. There was some tremendous talent. And again, you look at their work and you think that's as good as anything happening anywhere in the country. They were so plugged into what was happening internationally, really high quality. And it's been wonderful to see a lot of that material is coming back to us now. A lot of it's locally held. The things somebody bought for $50 back in 1962, and you can still find it around if you know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And we did a big show last year at the Knoxville Seven.
I was going to say, I knew the last couple of years.
It was such a revelation to see all that assembled. A lot of it was borrowed from local sources. We borrowed from the State Museum in Nashville. A few other places, and a lot we had acquired ourselves. Because when we first started showing work by local artists, things just started coming over the transom. It's been really nice that people that have been holding this stuff when we opened 27 years ago, nobody really wanted to talk about anything local. It was a different world. And I don't know if you were around you were pretty young then. So, In 1990, when we opened, we wanted to be Atlanta, I don't think any of us, nobody here, and I think this was true throughout the country. You wanted to be like the next bigger place. You'd want to be yourself. We were a little embarrassed about hillbillies, we like to pretend that we were kind of bigger and fancier than we were.
Sure.
And, you know, the world's so different now, and we embrace what's local and value what's indigenous and what came out of the ground here. We don't want something that's like sort of a big box variety. We want what's unique and kind of quirky and specific to this place.
Yeah.
And we've really benefited from that real shift in how we all think about our hometown and what's worth having and what's not and what's worth preserving. And it's really been I think a really positive thing all the way around.
Well, you've been, so you got, your graduate degree at Washington University.
Yeah.
In the early 90s.
Yeah. Early 90s.
You had said you kind of lived and done a lot of things. I think you definitely came to Knoxville and came to the museum definitely at that right time of a time to take advantage of a lot of that changing sort of thought pattern.
Timing is everything.
Yeah. Between the grad degree and coming to here, sort of what had you experienced? Where did you come from there?
My first job out of graduate school was running a gallery at a small college in upstate New York, which was Hamilton College, a beautiful place out in the middle of nowhere. Loved that place a lot. I went from there to Terre Haute, Indiana, to a really amazing little collection of American art that was formed in the late 30s and early 40s. And the premise there was that they had a chunk of money that had been left to start an art museum. And, you know, Terre Haute had been a fairly successful railroad industrial mm-hmm. town. And it struggled, has struggled in the intervening years. It's a real Rust Belt city. The idea was that, well, we've got this little bit of money. How do we use it? And the default position then would be, well, you go to Europe and you buy a bunch of expensive European things. That was culture with a capital C.
Sure.
And they had this kind of genius director who was the son of a prominent, like the black sheep of a local prominent family, mm-hmm. and was well trained and was an artist himself. And he went to New York and bought the newest thing by living artists, Grant Wood's last painting, a beautiful Thomas Hart Benton. It's a whole, you can just go down the list of what, buying what was then contemporary art, which was a really daring thing to do. And I learned from that, that, you know, you have to kind of work against the grain sometime.
Sure.
That was not, I'm sure a lot of people thought that was hard. Why would you want to buy that junk? You need old fancy stuff from Europe. And that's what a museum is supposed to be. And now they have this drop dead beautiful collection of that, kind of showing that moment, late '30s, early '40s
in Terre Haute, Indiana.
In Terre Haute. Yeah.
Terre Haute.
Terre Haute. Yeah. And I learned so much. I also learned, if you've ever spent time in Indiana, there's a great indigenous school of painting from the late 19th, early 20th century, these genius impressionist painters. And when I got here after one more stop in Wichita, Kansas, at Wichita okay. State, and I saw Catherine Wiley in the basement because we weren't showing it, because who wants to show, it's just some local person.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, we were doing a really high-end, rather interesting and successful series of contemporary shows. It got us good press around the country, really. It was a very high-profile thing. I don't think people loved it. People didn't really – we were a little out in front of our audience
mm-hmm.
to some extent. And I saw that Catherine Wiley, said, God, who is that? And that was just kind of, that was one of those kind of eureka moments. And that's Catherine Wiley, and she's from here. And I thought it was so beautiful and just such a genius painting. And things like that don't happen in a vacuum. They don't happen. You can't just have one artist working someplace. They're always part of a bigger kind of community, a bigger infrastructure of artists and institutions that support them and people that buy them. And artists are real hive. I think they're real hive people. They find one another, and I just don't, they mostly don't flourish in isolation. And
no, they absolutely do not.
Yeah, you know that for sure.
I can speak to that. But yeah, very often I've been most surprised if you go back, you know, some of the examples from even the waybacks from art history at the. What people would consider the capital C culture artists all hung out.
Yeah.
Or impressionists that we all know, like they all knew each other. They went to coffee shops. They argued politics on Tuesdays. It blows my mind. You know, those pockets of history and those pockets of creativity that over the course of centuries have continued to, you know, artists, both supporting each other as well as challenging each other.
Yeah. And those places where things that matter happen, there's this complicated mix of, you know, there's patronage and there's talent and there's some kind of underlying impetus for people to make things and to push the envelope. And,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if we're there yet in terms of visual culture in Knoxville, but we're not that far away. There's an amazing amount of things going on right now all over town. And there are, you know, studios popping up. Some of them connected with UT, some are independent folks. Some are like you. They got a day job that's kind of connected to their art making. Mm-hmm. We have a way that infrastructure, I think, is in its kind of skeletal form, but it's there. And
We've got a lot of, I dig right now, there are, I mean, obviously the big guns around this area is obviously like a Richard Jolly. But we've got Andy Softail, other regional artists like Robin Serber, who is just fantastic. You know, a lot of younger people coming up that are doing just really cool things.
Well, and some really important people that are connected to UT, like Jared Sprecher, who we just showed.
You guys just got done with that exhibit. Yeah. And he's
phenomenal.
That's incredible stuff.
Phenomenal stuff. And a nice guy, too.
Yeah.
There are a number of real stars at UT who, and I like it because they're really invested in this community, too. They're not placeholders waiting to go somewhere else. I feel like they're really committed to this community, and maybe they won't be here forever, but they're making a lot of things happen. And we're lucky. UT has been a real driver, at some periods more than others, in kind of providing the critical mass of people and money and sort of institutional support that you need to make, a really vital art scene. People like Denise Stewart Sanabria, who's a total genius.
I would advise, if anybody is listening, I mean, everybody that we have mentioned, I'll make show notes with websites and stuff. Denise's stuff over the past, what would you say, 8 to 10 years, when she's gone into that, the sort of the realism with the food.
I call it crazy realism.
It tells stories essentially with scenes of, you know, rotting cakes or with these incredibly elaborate backdrops.
It's food behaving badly, and they're so beautifully painted.
Amazing.
Her output is phenomenal. You mentioned Richard Jolly. You know, he and Tommy Rush have made such a commitment to this place and have invested so much here. And, you know, they could have gone anywhere, and they have chosen to stay here. I think they've been in their studio for close to 40 years now, doing the big major things that get shipped around the world. Did the big installation here.
Richard Jolly and Tommy Rush are both, we're talking like top three, top five glass artists.
Absolutely.
In the world.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is a really cool thing to have. And speaking again of artists supporting their local culture and their local community, both Richard and Tommy have been involved, I think, for 25 years with the Community School of the Arts.
Yeah.
We talked on our last episode or our last interviews, we talked to Jennifer Willard with the community school. And so they are incredibly talented people with a great studio that are giving their time, their talent.
That's really important to them. They're really invested in this community, and they love that program. I mean, that I think everything goes back to at some level, we all believe that what we do makes a real difference in somebody's life. And I think sometimes that's stretching it, but there are moments. And I think Community School for the Arts is one of those organizations that can say that with real confidence.
with an exclamation at the end.
Like, absolutely. Someone's life is different because of something that you did.
Sure.
And that's a great feeling. You can't claim that very often, but I think sometimes it's true. And I think if you can't see that once in a while, then what you're doing, maybe it's not so worthwhile.
Or sort of that, you figure out what it is that you're about and how you want to affect people. I'm just thinking about that. I mean, I had a lot of those sort of first slide moments, you know, but thinking about it in context of a museum where people think about like, oh, I'm at the museum now, you know, everybody be quiet and respectful and all that. I remember going in college. We took a trip to, I think it was the Corcoran up in D.C., and I saw, and I forget the name of it, but that huge Motherwell piece that's like 50. I mean, it's just crazy. And I'm getting like goosebumps even thinking about the impact that just seeing that had on me. I'm just thinking about it right now. And I get emotional just thinking about, you know, that somebody did something like that.
It's great when you have those. You don't get many of those moments in your life. And it's great when they happen.
And that's hopefully, like you said, like that's kind of, you guys have that work and those things that, you know, maybe somebody gets to have that moment here.
I hope so.
You know?
I really hope so. As I say, you often just don't know. Once in a while, you do know that something really important happened. We do a lot of work in with the community schools program, the after school, full service schools. It goes under different names, and that's been really exciting and fulfilling for us. Where you're really along with a bunch of other organizations that help that are partners in that program. You're really fulfilling some needs that people have, and instead of not dealing with first world problems necessarily. And that's been a really, really satisfying thing to be a part. A lot of great stories come out of that too.
Yeah.
And kids that just, their horizons are very limited for all kind of reasons. And
well, and maybe this is something that you guys have encountered as well. When if you're in a position, you're talking about first world problems. So many of us, as we go into adulthood or whatever we want to call it, you go from being limited to limiting yourself, right? And because I think that creative side is just beat out of all of us.
Yeah. That's what the world does.
And so any organization, I think that's mission is to, you know, keep that creativity strong, you know, in terms of knowing that there are people out there doing things or encouraging people to do it themselves.
Well, and creativity is something that's so much a part of everyone's DNA, and it really is shut down for all kind of reasons. I mean, every third grader is a great artist.
Yep.
And every eighth grader is not, and something happens in there. And I think partly the world does it to us. Partly we do it to ourselves.
Well, there's that, did you ever read that book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, that goes into that? Like by the time we're eight, which is third grade, you're learning, everybody's learning situation changes from, you know, oh, that's nice. You know, that's nice. Into like, okay, now it's time to learn how to work the machine or whatever.
Yeah. That kind of creativity doesn't serve us as a society, apparently.
And to me, to see a beautiful work of art can exist just to be a beautiful work of art. That is one of the most powerful things. There's many other things that it can do.
That's a big claim to make too. And in fact, we tend not, in my world, the museum world, we focus so much on all societal benefits.
Absolutely.
We sometimes lose sight that there's the sort of inherent value in something beautiful and intriguing and that's hard to make. And, thank you for bringing that up because we tend to talk about everything but the sort of transcendent moment of that Motherwell moment or that first slide moment when something magic happens.
Well, there is a transformative nature to art. You know, for me, if it's that Motherwell painting or if it's a song or if it is a thing that did not exist that now exists that has affected you in a certain way. And, I just think the more that people can see, literally see this kind of stuff, be close to it, it's not just that somebody else did this. It's that somebody, like for here, Buford Delaney, right? It's somebody that is from here. Or that somebody that's your could have been or could be your neighbor or could be you or could, you know, there's so
somebody
much.
That's,
you know.
The fact that someone's from here is kind of a portal for people. Say, I don't know much from art, but I love the Smoky Mountains. I mean, they're easy sort of points of connection that you can make. You made me think of something else, too, that's an important part of my journey sort of professionally and personally. I love looking at art. I love being around art. And it's been a it's been really hard for me to learn that that's not enough. I'd be happy just to put the paintings on the wall and call it a day. It's like, okay, we're done. And to understand that you have to, because that works for me, it doesn't work for everybody. And you have to do all kinds of things to interpret those things, to make them understandable, make them approachable, for them to, you have to provide lots of different portals for people. I don't need a portal. It's just all there for me. And it probably is for you too. And, but it just, it was a very long, slow lesson. Oh, okay. We got to do all these other things. And I think that's what we try to do as an organ, as an institution is sure. to how many ways can you make something, accessible and easy to, easy to approach and not scary. And, if you have a chance, come by and look at the visual views, this wonderful oh, yeah. installation of electronic art. And it's been fun to watch that because people think, I don't like contemporary art. I don't like new media stuff, blah, blah, blah. They're hooked instantly because there's nothing to know. They're just things that you interact with. And there's a kind of dialogue that happens with these because of the nature of these
interactive computer pieces,
generated images that know you're there and they respond to you, and it's a pretty neat thing.
I think that takes, you know, to a thought that Jasper Johns in an interview, however long ago or whatever it was, he was talking about somebody asked him what a particular painting meant or what it was about or whatever, and his answer was that his answer was essentially like, well, it means something to me, but to you, it may be something completely different.
That pisses people off, though.
It does.
They want the answer.
But it pisses people off on both sides, right? Because a lot of artists want to say, like, this is what I mean. I dig that. See, I like the more modern stuff like that with the visual view. The visual views, the interactive nature of that. That everybody comes away with a different perspective, you know, with a different engagement.
Yeah, it's a different way of experiencing a work of art. Because mostly they just sit, the old ones just sort of sit there, and for most people they're not very eloquent. There's one person 100 that just like some light bulb goes off. But modern and contemporary art is really intimidating for a lot of people, and we try to present it in the context of other things. So there's always something here that you'll like. But in my experience, people really struggle with new art, especially except like, the electronic stuff.
What is which it? Is,
what's, how am I supposed to feel? Like they and people don't like to feel dumb. Nobody likes to feel dumb. And I think, art museums as institutions have worked really hard for years to make people feel dumb, and we're trying to make people not feel dumb. You should feel smart when you walk in, smart and comfortable, like, oh, I belong here. And I'll,
yeah.
But it's hard to get to that point where you're not worried about, oh, I won't understand it. It's too hard. There's lots of secret knowledge that I don't have. And
This is a good thing to just like dig it. There's an intimidation factor.
They're huge, yeah. And working against that is our full time job is to defy all those expectations. If you can just get people in the door, that's part of being free. It's like, well, just let's lower one barrier.
You were saying something about how, you know, like we don't like to be made to feel dumb, right? And so there are artists out there that do like to make people feel dumb.
Yeah.
And I don't have time for that. Like I don't respond well to that either.
Well, that's a power you give them, and you can choose not to give them that power.
So what is I love this, the accessibility, that it's okay to not necessarily understand the artist's intention. That's okay. The hope is, or at least from my understanding, is the hope is that you give somebody the window or the door to then have the interest to find out.
Yeah.
Or to find out what a piece means, like, why, when I look at this piece, does it make me feel this way? And maybe it's a purely personal answer.
Yeah, and the way I like to look at it, when I've been yelled at by, this actually happened because somebody doesn't understand something, and people, most people, this isn't so much true anymore because I think people under 30 or so are much less intimidated by non-representational things and electronic things, and but their seniors are a little bit put off when if there's not a tune to it.
Sure.
If they can't say, well, that's a dog and that's a person and that's a bowl of fruit and on the simplest level. And my response always is like, say Norman Rockwell,
sure,
who's a great, great artist, but people sort of check off, oh, well, here's the story and here's what it means. I'll move on to the next. And there's actually a lot more going on there, but they're abstract and formal things with color and form, yeah, that he's manipulating to tell a story, but he's doing it in the most.
But you could look at it immediately and tell it's Thanksgiving,
right? And yeah, anything that you can sort of, okay, I'm done with that, then you'll never go back to it. And actually, his work, you can keep going back and finding more things, but mostly what you can understand in 5 seconds is probably just not very interesting, mm-hmm, to start with, and things that annoy you are probably worthy of some more time and study and introspection and things that you didn't. I know things that I left me cold when I was 30 really moved me 30 years later.
Sure.
You understand life better. You understand the world better. Or things have happened to you. Things that you're not going to like or get things. Some things you're just not going to get, and that's okay too. Maybe you go back in 20 years and you say, now I see.
Every time an artist that does that for me, who I've always enjoyed, but I found that my appreciation for his stuff has changed, like why I have responded to it, is Rothko.
Yes. Yes.
And as you get, As I have, you know, you like you said, like you go through things, you go through life, and you go, you know, maybe when I was younger, I just appreciated the color, this is really neat how he has done this, literally the sort of technique aspect. But then you learn more about his life, or then you learn more about whys and the this and the that and the context in which so many pieces were created, and you can start putting yourself in that context.
Yeah, and I think people should always remember that when they look at a work of art or anything for that matter, that that work of art is not fixed. You're not fixed. You're it's all dynamic, and there's a relationship, yep, there. And you know, it's like putting your hand in the river. You can't dip your hand to the river twice because it
always changes.
Each time.
Yeah,
and you know you and the work of art, or you and whatever, you're a thing, and that thing will be different in a day or a year, mm-hmm, or 10 years. You know, that relationship's going to be different. You're going to be different. And I think the art is different too, although we think it sort of sits there. It doesn't change, but it probably really does.
Yeah. I think as you putting it in that context too, like when you read a book when you were 20, you know, because you had to for an English class or, you know, or for whatever, and you read that book 20 years later, and all of a sudden, all the old people in that book are your age now, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's why that happened.
And I think really good art, you never get tired of it. You never wear it out. You never exhaust it. Bad art, not so much.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay, I got that joke. Let's go on to the next thing.
Well, so, and then that gets into another whole thing about like bad, good, does it last?
And who says it's bad and good?
Yeah. Especially now, in a different, and this kind of leads us into definitely a part of the conversation that I wanted to have too, is now in this culture in 2017, where there are no, you know, necessarily like there are no gatekeepers anymore.
For anything.
For anything.
Apparently.
I mean, I'm making a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can do anything. But, you know, there are challenges, I think, from the art maker's standpoint now that are all new. There's challenges and exciting opportunities, right? So you can, and so that's on one side of that, you know, on one side of that wall. On the other side is the institution, the museum. So you've got your larger thing there. What kind of challenge?
And that's a problem because we're one of the last gatekeepers left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're still working on a very old model where we say out of all the million and trillion things out there in the world you could look at, we're gonna choose a tiny little sliver and tell you that's good or that's worth looking at, and that's a pretty elitist, and that's a real kind of an old fashioned idea. I don't know how else to do it.
Right.
But I think museums have what for a while looked like, oh gosh, this is really a problem because it's all digital now. It doesn't really matter if you have the real thing, you can get the electronic version. But I think now that actually holding and showing and taking care of real things that have tangible presence in the world and materiality and physicality, I think that's our real strength because we're one of the last places left.
Where you have
that experience
and to have a thoughtfully curated experience.
Yeah, but curating is a problematic idea. The world used to be much more curated for all of us. There were three major newspapers and five magazines. We all got kind of at three networks. We got our information curated, and I think looking back at rather thoughtful and well done way. And now we live in this kind of anarchy and with a very unclear hierarchy, and it's just there's just a lot of noise, and it's hard to know what to think. It's hard to know what is this real information? Is it fake? Is it fake news?
Sure.
I hope we can kind of hold in the art museum world, we can kind of hold onto that kind of old fashioned idea that there, you know, you carefully choose a handful of objects to contemplate and interact with and enjoy. I think that's going to work for us in the long, but maybe it's like the Chinese scholar and his beautiful ink painting scrolls, mm-hmm. as a kind of solitary aristocratic activity that's opened available to very few who've educated themselves over many years. I don't want it to be that, but I think there's an element of that kind of exquisiteness.
Sure.
In there. I like to think it's exquisiteness is available to anyone who wants to walk in the door.
Well, I think that there's a value. I mean, admittedly, my career has both benefited and not from that, you know, what you call sort of the anarchy of experience of their, you know, I think, you know, maybe I'm making all of this up because, you know, 30 years ago, I don't know, I was, you know, 30 years ago, I was nine. But, you know, there's nobody to call. There's no, you know, you hear these stories of back in the day of people dropping their portfolios off or getting discovered or all of these kind of things. And it's a much harder row to, it's easier to get your stuff out there. But it's a harder row to hoe in terms of...
Well, so can a million other people.
Exactly.
And, yeah, I don't know how you make your... As an artist, I don't know how you make yourself heard against this, all this background noise. I think it's even harder is with the blank screen or the blank canvas, whatever, the blank piece of paper, what the hell do you do? When you have the whole history of art, of world art at your fingertips... Where do you start? That to me is the real dilemma in 2017. If you're a maker, if you're creating things, how do you kind of tune out all that information in your head and in the world and do what means something to you and that communicates something that is valuable and important to you? And I think artists they have that innate ability to do that. They're curating the world for our benefit and showing us some particular slice of reality that
yeah.
that they as they understand it, and the good ones somehow they can do that in a way that speaks to it, to other people, or that they communicate something mm-hmm. that's sometimes hard to put into words. That's the other thing that annoys people, because I like this, but I can't really say why. Well, that's okay. There are nonverbal ways of
you can enjoy the experience. Yeah,
and it is an experience. This is really heavy. Wow,
it's good, but, right? It's good stuff. This is why you got to talk.
Brilliant, yeah.
Got to talk for a while, you know. I do want to be. Hey, do you want a glass of water?
I'm good. Yeah.
Okay. There's water over to our side. For those of you who are listening or watching, you can see, I suppose. No, I didn't push record on the video thing.
Oh, thank God. I feel 100% better.
Well,
you can show slides.
There we go. There we go. Hold on just a second. I'm going to turn it on now. I just ran out of recording space. Easy enough.
Okay. We filled it up. Okay.
We filled it up. So we'll see, and the other thing about it, I leave it in like warts and all too. So all that's people will be hearing. But so yeah, no, the nature of that artistic beast, man, you're talking about that blank canvas and what do you put on it? Knowing that thousands of years from caves to now have been of art making has been done. That is a,
it's intimidating.
That's a crusher.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how I personally approach that canvas. Literally just make marks. Working with a kid with Joseph from community school with their side by side exhibit, got a big, blank canvas and I just start marking. You know, like
how did he respond? Was he like, whoa, what are you doing? Or did he kind of get it? Or?
Yeah, well, a little bit of a, he he's a kid a little more plaintive, a little more sort of thoughtful. Like, well, maybe I should do this or maybe I shouldn't.
High school students can be very, you're not supposed to do that.
Well, that's how a lot of people are. That's sort of like, you're not supposed to do this.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm fortunate in that I don't understand that. About like you're supposed to do this or not supposed to do that. Like something is not wired from
you're a problem child.
Talk to my, so there's a reason I'm an only child. Thanks mom. But yeah, the ability to, the ability and the will to make mistakes. Because even those famous artists, even Richard Jolly, even Andy Softail, even those are the locals, like they didn't start out making what they are making now.
No, it's been a journey. It's an evolution.
Yeah.
And you bring up something else too that I think it's important to say a little bit about that when you talk about art and culture, I think people picture that in Roman letters and
Corinthian columns.
And I think it just has, or maybe that's just my head, but I think that's an image people carry around, that it's something kind of outside of their experience. It's nice. I guess you're supposed to care about this, but I don't really get it. And, and I think one of our challenges as a visual arts institution is to sort of change that thinking and get people saying this is something that really matters and these are people wrestling with fundamental issues for them and for us and it's not something outside of our everyday experience. It's very much sort of embedded in everything that we do and who we are and how we see ourselves and how we understand the world. We struggle a lot with how do you present art in that way without all the curly cues and the implied curly cues and the being on top of a pedestal.
Yeah.
I think that's a real hard thing to overcome. It's a kind of prejudice, I guess. You put art in this box, and you put sports here, and you put you know, we tend to put everything, all parts of our lives in boxes.
We compartmentalize.
Yeah.
That, well, it's sort of the 80s movie version of life that we all want to live, that the jocks hang out on this side of the school and the cool kids are over here and all that. And the one thing that I find very interesting that I have seen over and over, my son is about to turn 16 and he has friends that, and he himself has been involved in visual arts and music and sports. So you've got a lineman on the football team that can play piano like a beast. That can, you know, so there's these.
I don't think that generation compartmentalizes as much as we did.
Yeah.
Or do. I just the kind of the kids that I'm around and exposed to and can listen to, they're just much more relaxed about all kinds of things.
I think there's something to be said. There's the bad stuff, obviously, about social media and about, you know, the 1,000 points of anarchy and all this kind of thing. But I'm going to be really curious when the kids now that are 15, what will they be doing when they are 25 and 30? Because they are used to taking pictures. They are used to presenting things and or being presented in some of the, you know.
That's why I think for them, maybe art is not something in a gilded frame. I just think images and visual things are so much. That's how you go upstairs and watch people walk around with their phone, because this is how they see the world. They can really, it's like, no, put your phone down and look. But that's that for a lot of people, it's important to make those images. And we're drowning in images. And I think that's just, it's not a bad thing. It just is, but I don't know how it's bound to make us think about image making in a different way.
When everybody has the ability to do it. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but I mean, when the printing press was invented, people were pissed off, you know, cause now everybody can,
But I still think it makes me think there will always be a hunger for images made by hand.
Sure.
That are, or part, that somehow you can't just do with your phone.
Yeah.
And that's okay too. A lot of people do great stuff with their phones and make what I think of as real art, but.
Well, we've had the, you know, you were talking about UT and they have a great sort of a rich art program and culture. And they also have, you know, I've gotten to meet a lot of the design and the art students over the years, and the design students in particular, all the young people without exception are interested in tactile things. They may not think that that's a thing that is part of, you know, will be part of their life,
I think the whole makers movement is partly about that. And that we're talking about the materiality of things, of actual things, not like things on a screen, but actual
physical things that you can make and throw, whatever. No, I think that is incredibly important. And that's a neat thing that's become part of, even again, sort of back to the Knoxville kind of thing, like our local culture, you know?
Well, it does get back to that, because it's very much about what's right here and what is literally going out of the ground. But my new model for culture is thinking about it as kudzu, and not you know, teacup and a raised pinky, but like something that's just literally coming up out of the ground and is everywhere.
Yeah. And once it's there, it stays. Unless someone deliberately tries to chop it down.
It's really vigorous and strong and healthy. I mean, the kudzu metaphor gets problematic if you keep going with it. We've got a wonderful, huge photographic triptych by a very famous artist named David Hilliard. He was driving through Knoxville with friends one time, and he loved the, you know, there along Chapman Highway, there's those sort of whole forests that are covered with kudzu.
Oh yeah.
And he did this beautiful triptych of a fellow who I've actually met. He's it was a kid that was living here, and this sort of panorama of all this kudzu, because we were happy we were able to acquire it, because it's such a Knoxville kind of image. But this is a big national figure that loved our kudzu and loved the landscape. And said, I love it when the big world and little Knoxville kind of intersect like that in a really interesting way. To me, it's a metaphor for what we're trying to do here and being about the big world out there, but also about in a very granular way about what's happened here in terms of the visual arts and what artists have responded to this place and all that meant good and bad and are still continuing to do.
Well, I think we've covered a lot.
A lot of territory.
It's a lot of territory. And I want to respect your time and everybody else's. And, I feel like we can probably have another conversation again. But I do want to.
Well, thank you for doing this. I hope it was better than Willard.
Called out. Jay Wow. Hey, if you would, though, please leave everybody with some recommendations and kind of tell us what's next for. For the KMA, what are you guys up to?
We're kind of fixated on Buford Delaney right now. We're doing a series of projects over the next few years.
Okay.
I think they've been evolving, and I think where we are now is next fall of 2018, we're going to do a big Joseph Delaney show. We have a lot of holdings ourselves. We thought that we've really been pushing Buford because his work was impossible to get until recently, and we thought we should kind of circle back and show some of our holdings. A lot of locally. Joseph died. He lived in Knoxville before he died, and died here. So people knew him. There's a lot stronger local connection because he came back late in life, and Buford came for rare visits, and not as many people knew him personally. And there's still family here, so we're going to do that next year, and then. In the fall of 2019, we're going to do a big show of Buford's work, probably connected to some of the work that is still in Paris. We had hoped to bring the whole. There was a big show in Paris last year that some of us went over for. It was really amazing. So there's Buford Delaney with all of Paris at his feet. But we'll bring some of that work here in the context of his development as an artist in that. The last several decades of his life when he lived in Paris. And we're trying to, around that, we're trying to build with the help of the East Tennessee History Center and the Beck Center and the Links Incorporated and some other community groups. And people keep raising their hands like, wow, I want to help with this. Trying to construct around that kind of an ongoing project about making Buford Delaney as famous in his hometown as he is in the rest of the world, and really introducing young people to him as a model and an example, kind of celebrating his achievement, that of his brother Joseph, and kind of lifting him up as here's a great thing that happened in Knoxville, Tennessee, and with this and Buford especially carried Knoxville with him to New York to Paris, and he was very much a Knoxville. He was formed here, and I think he was a great friend of James Baldwin and really kind of a mentor to James Baldwin. And I think a lot of things that came out of James Baldwin's mouth first came out of Buford's mouth. and I can't prove that, but they were so close over so many years. The way I see it is like here's Knoxville spreading out to the whole world. It's
sure,
like it's a great Knoxville story. So we're working. We're kind of groping our way. How do we make that a permanent thing? How do we if you go through Knox County schools by the sixth grade, you should know certain things about Buford Delaney. Why he's important and.
Sort of cement his place in history.
So we're trying to figure out how we as a community. This is much bigger than the KMA, but as a community project to make that happen. In the near term, there's a wonderful American Impressionist show we're doing this fall that'll open in August. It connects to some people like Catherine Wiley some of the people that she studied with are represented in this show. So we try to make our whole exhibition program connect laterally or otherwise to what's always on view, the local work, our more contemporary work mm-hmm. that we show on the third floor. What else is happening?
Well, the summer, right, you guys have a lot of, like, art programs and...
I have Summer Art Academy going on right now. It's fantastic. The Ann and Steve Bailey Hall, where Richard Jolly's gigantic installation is filled with kids all summer. That's June and most of July. And I think you can go online and see if there are places to fill up. It's pretty full, but there might be slots in there if you're looking for a place to put your kids for. They do it a week at a time, either morning or afternoon. Awesome. Yeah, we have a really vigorous education outreach program, which is often not visible because it's out there in the community, and we don't kind of push that enough, people need to know about that's going on all the time, and I think that's the. That's where the real stories are. That's where you're really interacting with kids, where that really makes a difference in their lives, I think.
Sure. That first slide moment.
Yeah. I love that phrase. I'm gonna remember that. The first slide moment.
Oh, definitely. Well, I hope that this encourages some folks out there to have to go search out their own. A big thanks.
Come by and have a first slide moment. I love that idea. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, come by, any of you guys out there that want to learn more. Again, it's knoxart.org, and I'll make show notes in the post. But this has been David Butler, the executive director, and it's just been a really cool experience to kind of. To me, talk with somebody who has been around and seen so much, from art to history to the people making it to the people presenting it to the people experiencing.
It's because I'm so old.
I think you've got a while left. But thanks so much, and thanks to everybody for listening.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. I am Chris McAdoo. Again, this has been David Butler, and we'll see you next time around. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Enjoyable Listen Time. This was recorded live at the Knoxville Museum of Art. If you enjoyed what you heard and want to hear more, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and all of the podcast places. Share with your friends, your enemies, your neighbors, your acquaintances. Leave us a review and tell everybody you know. Thanks so much.